group of Dallas Seminary students and I every week pick at the Ruth Street Clinic. Around lunch hour, we take off our lunch hour from seminary, go over and march up and down in front of the Ruth Street Clinic. I have a few signs. One of them says, adoption, not abortion. Another one says, 4,500 died today. Another one says, capital punishment is wrong for the innocent. That gets their attention. Every time one person gets capital punishment, some vicious, wicked, brutal murder, you have a handful of people with candles down by the prison, and today 4,500 innocent babies got capital punishment, and how many people are protesting? Why is it that Christians aren't involved? I used to wonder, as we march up and down in front of Ruth Street Clinic, who in the world owns this building? I wish I had never asked, because as I prodded, I discovered to my chagrin that one of the largest abortion clinics in Texas, the largest one in the city of Dallas, Ruth Street Clinic, near Fitzhugh and Central, the building is owned by two Roman Catholics and a born-again Christian who attends a Bible church. Why? Well, we had a born-again president who said this: I personally am opposed to abortion. I would never allow my wife to have one, but I would not oppose it as a policy in the United States. Why? Harold Honer, one of our professors, asked his class not too long ago, what is the greatest problem in America today? Is it ignorance or is it apathy? And one of the students said, I don't know and I don't care. That perhaps is the greatest problem in America today. It should be socially, and of course this includes politically involved. I think before we can answer that, we have to ask ourselves why some Christians are not socially and politically involved. The suggestions I take here from a book entitled Inasmuch As by David Moberg, who I think analyzed very well as a Christian sociologist what's wrong with Christians in their lethargy to get involved in society. Number one, an overreaction to the liberal social gospel. Now, many of you may be aware of the history, but let me briefly run through it. Up until 1900, every major institution in eastern United States was still Orthodox. Harvard, Yale, Princeton were all started by evangelical Christians. They remained Orthodox from their inception right up until the year 1900. The year 1900, exactly that year, someone was accepted on the staff at Harvard University. He had questions about the virgin birth of Christ. He wasn't quite sure. After he was appointed, he was quite sure Jesus was not virgin born. That started what is known as modern liberalism or modernism, which denied the miracles of the Bible, the virgin birth, the deity of Christ, the substitutionary atonement, the bodily resurrection. Against that, there was a reaction of a group called fundamentalists, which meant that they believed in those fundamental doctrines of the inspiration of the Bible, the virgin birth, substitutionary atonement, the deity of Christ, the bodily resurrection, and the second coming. Between 1900 and 1930, this liberalism-fundamentalism controversy raged. By 1930, liberalism had won every major institution in Eastern America. By the year 1930, there was not left a single Orthodox institution. Now, as a reaction to that liberal takeover, many fundamentalists said, we'll just keep the spiritual gospel and let them have that social gospel. As a matter of fact, it was an overreaction, because in overreacting against that, we stressed missionaries, pastors, evangelists. These were all high and holy callings, but politicians, lawyers, this is something that perhaps if you can't do anything else, it might be something necessary for you to make a living, but certainly not Christian vocation. And if Christians can avoid that type of thing and do something godly and spiritual, it would be far better. And the bottom line was, you can't concentrate on everything, so we'll concentrate on people's eternal destiny rather than their temporal comfort. That was an overreaction. We now see it as an overreaction, but we're about two generations late and trying to catch up. Secondly, there was the misuse of prophecy to conclude that things are hopeless. Same fundamentalists who believed the Bible was the Word of God and all those fundamental doctrines said, the Bible tells us in the last days, Christ won't find faith on the earth. Things will grow worse and worse. And consequently, as a result of that, many became pessimistic. Now, not everyone got their black robes and went out in the treetop and sat there and waited for the rapture, but there were people who overreacted in that kind of mentality, and many others just simply said, well, why, to quote D.L. Moody, why polish the brass rails of a sinking ship? And to quote another, in fact, the most widely heard radio preacher in the world, J. Vernon McGee, said, and I quote, I don't have time to clean up the cesspool. I'm too busy fishing in it. And that mentality of why polish the brass rails of a sinking ship, I don't have time to clean up the cesspool, I'm too busy fishing in it, that misuse of biblical prophecy to negate any motivation there may have been for social things led to a lot of Christians to withdraw from the political and the social arenas. Thirdly, a mistaken view that the social good is not spiritual. That if you want to do something spiritual, like hand out a tract or witness or evangelize, become a missionary, teach a Sunday school lesson, yes, but to be involved simply in cleaning up dirty people, feeding hungry, getting involved socially, that's something that is second best, and we want to do the most important. D, an overemphasis on individual piety to the neglect of social responsibility. Carl Henry, our champion, who wrote two books on this topic and who was the one who almost single-handedly aroused our social interest in his book, The Uneasy Conscience of Evangelicals, wrote a thick book entitled Christian Personal Ethic, followed by a thin book, Aspects of Social Ethic. Now, the very fact there were two books, one was thick and one was thin, shows what was wrong with the evangelical movement. Why is it that we so highly stressed individual piety and neglected social responsibility? Why is it, in fact, that we separated the two into two books? Are they not one and the same? As a matter of fact, I was reading Mark Twain, one of favorite American authors, not too long ago, in a very unsuspected place. Mark Twain came up with one of his bitter satires, but he hit the nail right on the head. Now, he was not a Christian. In fact, he was quite anti-Christian, but he had some very penetrating insights. Listen to this one. In their private life, they are true to every obligation. Yet in every session, they violate them all and do it without shame, because honor to party is above honor to themselves. By vote, they do wrongful things every day in the party interests, which they could not be persuaded to do in private life. In the interest of party expediency, they give solemn pledges, they make solemn compacts. In the interest of party expediency, they repudiate them without even a blush. They would not dream of committing these strange crimes in their private life. Then he goes on to say this, there are Christian private morals, but there are no Christian public morals at the polls or in Congress or anywhere else except here and there and scattered around like lost comets in the solar system. Now, as I pondered these words, Mark Twain hit me in the solar plexus with this. His Christianity is of no use to him and has no influence upon him when he is acting in public capacity. He has sound and sturdy private morals, but he has no public morals, end quote. There are a lot of reasons why Christians were not involved. One of them is we stressed private ethics and neglected public ethics, made them indeed two different standards, so that somebody like Geraldine Ferraro, who comes from a Catholic background, can say, I'm personally opposed to abortion, but if you want to have an abortion, I'm not going to pass a law saying you can't. Someone like Jimmy Carter, who was a born-again Christian, came from a Southern Baptist background, could say exactly the same thing when it came to the abortion issue. I am personally opposed to it, but I favor it as a matter of public policy. We have sturdy private ethics, but no public ethics. E, stressing fellowship of believers to the neglect of ministry to unbelievers. Dare I mention that in a church named Fellowship Bible Church? You know, Christians are great on fellowship. Food, fun, and fellowship, the three F's of Christianity. We're great on fellowship, not too good on ministry. You can get a whole lot more people to a Christian party than you can to a picketing or protesting event, I know. You can get a whole lot more people to come and sip coffee with the saints than you can to go down to the polls and make an impact on society. We stress fellowship rather than ministry. A misbelief that politics are essentially dirty and threaten Christian purity. Now, there may be a near truth to say that politicians are essentially dirty. That may be close to the truth. But to say politics are essentially dirty is to call unclean what God has called clean. God ordained human government. God set up human government. And dare we say that an institution ordained of God is something unfit for a Christian to participate in? It seems to me that that comes near to a form of blasphemy to call clean where unclean what God has called clean. Another unbiblical isolation from the world doctrine rather than biblical separation from worldliness. I think I was a Christian about 15 years before I discovered where the world was. I used to think the world was out there. You say it is. No, it isn't. The world is not out there. You say, well, much learning doth make thee mad. No? Not the world the Bible is asking us to separate from. That's not out there. I used to think it was somehow in saloons. Maybe the bricks that a saloon was made out of were evil and you could stay away from those. Or maybe there's evil chemicals in nicotine or alcohol or something. You know, when I discovered where the world was, it was a shock to me. 1 John 2:15, love not the world. 2:16, all that is in the world. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. World's not out there. World's in here. The world's inside of me. God doesn't want us to separate from the political, the social, the people world out there. He wants us to separate from lust and pride. That's the worldliness of which Christians are warned in the scripture. Not isolation from the world, but separation from worldly lust. Also, there's the naive assumption that getting people saved is enough. Now, bless his heart, W.A. Criswell is one of the great men of God down through the years and has preached through the Bible verse by verse, but I sat there one Sunday morning and heard him say, and I quote, "We have a social program at First Baptist Church. We believe in getting people saved." That's wonderful, but that's not a social program. A social program goes far beyond the doctrine of justification by faith. Getting people to come down an aisle and commit their lives to Jesus Christ is only one step of salvation. And there are three steps in salvation. There's also sanctification and glorification, the other two steps. And that naive kind of belief that getting people born again is automatically going to get them to know how to vote is a proof, was proven in the very presidential election in which a Southern Baptist became president. I mean, what an embarrassment it was to most Americans. I'm one of the few Christians who didn't vote for Jimmy Carter, so I can say this with a little more gusto. As well, I got the tip off when he said, my favorite theologians are Paul Tillich and Reinhold Niebuhr. I happen to teach theology. Most Christians probably never heard of those guys. None of them believe in any one of the fundamental doctrines. None of them believe in the virgin birth, the deity of Christ, the substitutionary atonement, the bodily resurrection, the second coming, or any fundamental teaching of the Bible. And those were his favorite theologians. So I said to myself, self, this guy may be born again, but he is theologically illiterate. He doesn't really know, and therefore I am questioning whether or not he's going to be really applying Christian biblical truths to the political arena. And he didn't, by and large, do that well, as the abortion issue illustrates. Can you imagine living in Hitler Germany at the time of the Holocaust and having Christians in office saying, I do not personally agree with what Hitler is doing, but I'm going to vote for him? Hitler only killed 6 million Jews. We've already killed 18 million unborn children. Hitler used to take some of the Jews and skin them and make lampshades out of them. We make paperweight novelty items. You can buy $98.70 out of biological firm in Chicago. You can buy a little embryo encased in plastic paperweight. In Australia, I just came back a few weeks ago from Australia, you can get a necklace with little embryos, dried embryos, hanging from the necklace. We must apply our ethics to the political, to the public. Private ethics is not enough. Why is it that two Roman Catholics and a born-again Christian own the largest slaughterhouse in the city of Dallas? Well, I ask a little further. Why is it that one goes to a Bible church? And here's the answer I got. The one that went to a Bible church said to his wife before he rented the clinic out in this business too, he said, you know, we're going to be renting it to people who do abortions there. What do you think? And his born-again Christian wife said to him, honey, I would like to think there would be a place that our daughter could go if she got in trouble. Why Christians should be socially involved. The naive assumption that getting people saved or even getting them to attend a Bible church is enough. Then there's the sin of non-concern about the moral erosion of our society. A lot of us just aren't concerned that the world is going to hell. A lot of us aren't concerned that America was conquered by humanism between 1961 and 1981. In fact, most of us don't even know that. Most of us think that things are getting bad. No, they're not. The humanists already won between 1961 and 81. We're just struggling to see if, perchance, we might be able to get a foot back in the door. Because between 1961 and 1981, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled, get this, that you cannot teach the Declaration of Independence in American public schools. Now let me prove that. What does the Declaration of Independence say? We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they're endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, there are four basic doctrines there. Creator, creation of man, the belief in supernatural acts, and the belief that there are God-given moral absolutes. Those are the four basic Judeo-Christian tenets inscribed on our birth certificate as Americans, 1776, July 4th. Between 1961 and 1981, here's what the court ruled. You cannot teach creator, creation, even alongside of evolution, anything has to do with the supernatural or any God-given moral absolutes. In fact, you cannot even put the Ten Commandments on a bulletin board. The Supreme Court ruled in 1980. 1961, they said, you can't pray. They said humanism is a religion. 1962, they said you can't pray. 1963, said you can't read the Bible. 1968, they said you cannot forbid teaching evolution. 1973, they said you can kill anyone before they're born because they're not a person. 1980, they said you can't post the Ten Commandments on a bulletin board. And in January 5th, 1982, case began December 7th, 1981, they ruled can't teach creation, creator, or supernatural in the public schools. That means that the Declaration of Independence is unconstitutional. Now, I'm not an attorney, nor am I a dummy. The Declaration of Independence can't be unconstitutional. But we live in a country in which that was ruled. Why did that happen? Because between 1930 and 1960, after the fundamentalism-liberalism conflict, we withdrew from society. We sent missionaries and evangelists and had Bible teachers, and Sunday school was holy and everything, but we didn't train lawyers and judges and politicians. We left that for the liberals, the modernists, the secularists, the humanists to do, and they did it. And we wonder why they took over. It's pretty easy to win a football game if the other team will just withdraw from the field. Any team in the league could win against any other team if they withdraw from the field. What are the biblical reasons for social involvement? First of all, it's a command of Scripture. Philippians 2:4, look not every man his own things, but also those of others. Now, that's not a verse for cheating on exams, as some of my students used to think. It's a verse for being concerned about other people, their needs. Galatians 6:10, do good to all men, especially those of the household of faith. That's a pretty broad, sweeping statement, isn't it? Do good, that's as wide as you can call it, all men, that's as far as you can do it. The example of Christ, healing, feeding, exhorting, saying to render to Caesar what was Caesar's, paying his taxes. We've got Christians today who think that they're doing their Christian duty by withholding their taxes. The Bible says Jesus even commanded his disciples to go fishing to get money to pay their taxes, and Romans 13 commands us to pay taxes, and we think we're being spiritual by withholding taxes. That's one of our God-given obligations, to pay taxes. The urging of the apostle, the practice of the early church, the nature of true religion, with pure and undefiled as this, visit the widows in their affliction, do something practically, socially, the result of God's love. How can we say we love God and not love others? The command of Jesus to be salt and light. Salt penetrates, light illuminates. All of these, we know the biblical basis, and to him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. There are also a number of motives for social involvement. Should be done for Christ's sake, 1 Peter 2:13. Submit yourself to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake. Don't do it just because it'd be great for America or it would help us survive better. Do it for Christ's sake. Should be done with Christ's love. The love of Christ constrains us. Should be done to Christ himself. And as much as you've done it to the least of these, you've done it to me. Should be done to win others to Christ. Do all things that by all means you might win some. 2 weeks ago, I was in Washington, D.C. A group of Christian leaders were planning a big event for next year, the International Council on Biblical Inerrancy. We met with Colson, Armstrong, a number of Christians in high positions in the cabinet. I was impressed by Phil Armstrong. What a dedicated Christian he is. What an example. There aren't very many people that you can point to in the United States Senate and say, that's a Christian. He's living like a Christian. He's acting like a Christian. He's studying his Bible. He's practicing it. But there are a few, thank God, for some examples. We're commanded to be salt and light. Colson gave us two stirring challenges along with the chaplain of the Senate, both of whom urged upon us that we are going to, for the next 2 years, experience a tremendous backlash in America on everything that we want to do by way of social involvement because of the candidacy of Pat Robertson for president. Both of them were very deeply concerned about that. They said the media is going to paint us all in the same broad brush. We're all going to be looking like we do the same kooky things, rebuking hurricanes and clearing phlegm out of people's throat on TV. and we're all going to be made to look exactly like Pat Robertson as a result of his presidency. They pled with him not to run because it's going to set our causes back. Some of them maybe a decade or more, because his chances for winning are very slim, but the chances for the other side making hay, because they control the media, out of him and making him look ridiculous and all other Christians with him, are much greater. We're going to find it even more difficult to do what we're here tonight to get inspired to do as a result of his running for president. We're commanded to be salt and light in society. We cannot withdraw. We must make important distinctions that I'd like to make later on to help us to avoid this. Now, what are the biblical methods of social responsibility? First of all, the church should preach it prophetically. Paul said, I have not shunned to declare unto you the whole counsel of God. If you preach the whole Bible, you're going to get around to the verses on social responsibility. If you preach just parts of it, you never will get around to it. But there are numerous verses. Romans 13, 1 Timothy chapter 2, just to mention two chapters. We'll be quoting from them in a moment. The church should preach it. Christians should practice it morally. Now, here we come to a very difficult question in our society today. How do we balance between two things? One, social pragmatism on the one hand, and trying to Christianize America on the other hand. Pat Robertson, the theonomy group, the dominion theology of the charismatic, the so-called manifest sons of God doctrine on the one hand, appealing to American sentiments, they're telling us, let's get back to our Christian roots. Whoa, right there. Two or three fallacies about that. First of all, America never was a Christian country. Never. Never was a Christian nation. When did we start? 1776. Who wrote the Declaration of Independence? Thomas Jefferson. Was he a Christian? No, he's a deist. Know what a deist is? Someone who believes in God, someone who believes that God created the world, someone who believes in moral principles, even believed in the final day of judgment, but who does not believe that Jesus was the Son of God, does not believe in the virgin birth, does not believe in the bodily resurrection of Christ. In fact, here's what Jefferson did. He took his scissors and literally cut every miracle out of the Bible and threw in the scrap and pasted the rest together, and the U.S. Congress some years later even promulgated his Bible. I have a copy of it at home. Here's how it ends. And they put Jesus in the sepulcher and rolled the stone and departed. Period. He didn't believe in the resurrection. He said someday the churches will come to believe the virgin birth is in the same category as Jupiter springing from the brains of Minerva, just like an ancient Greek or Roman myth. Jefferson was not a Christian. This was not a Christian nation. Let me name one other person who signed the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Paine. He wrote two books, The Age of Reason. I challenge you to go down to your local store and get a copy of these books and read. Not only was he not a Christian, he was one of the most militant anti-Christians who ever lived in America. His books riddle the Bible. He says it's full of errors and contradictions and absurdities. He was a revolutionary. He was a deist revolutionary. Now, we have a lot of people today who are saying, let's get back to our Christian America. Number one, it was never a Christian country. Number two, to the degree that there was a strong Christian influence in early America, pilgrims, for example, they were post-millennialist. Now, if you don't know what a post-millennialist is, it's time for a little theology lesson right now. A premillennialist is someone who believes that we're not going to bring in the millennium, that only Christ can bring in the millennium, that this world is ultimately going to be judged, is going to end in a great tribulation, and it's going to end in the Battle of Armageddon at the end of that tribulation period, and that man is just about going to destroy himself, and at the nick of time, Jesus Christ is going to return to earth at the end of that tribulation period and set up a thousand-year kingdom and turn this into a paradise regained. That's a pre-millennial view. That's what we believe. A post-millennialist believes that you and I today are going to Christianize the world, and we are going to legislate Christian principles until most of the world is converted and becomes a virtual millennium, at the end of which time, after we have brought in the millennium, Christ will come. Now, almost all the early American Christians were post-millennialists. Now, if somebody says, let's get back to our Christian roots, I say, whoa, whoa. One, we're never Christian to begin with. Declaration of Independence written by a deist. Two, the degree to which there were many Christians before that in Christian influence, they were post-millennialists. Is that what you want us to be? Furthermore, did you ever hear about the Pilgrims? Do you know why there's a state called Rhode Island? Because the Pilgrims persecuted anybody who didn't believe the same way they did. There was no religious liberty under the Pilgrims. You either believe, you say, how can that be? They came from England. That's the irony, isn't it? They came from England where they didn't have religious liberty, and they didn't give anybody religious liberty under them either. He who does not know history is condemned to repeat its errors. Now, that always stirs up a bit of patriotism in an American Christian. Say, let's get back to our Christian roots. But let's not be naive about it. We weren't Christian, and to the degree that we were, you want us to become post-millennialist, persecuting Baptists so they have to run over to Rhode Island and have another state where they're free? You wouldn't have a Bible church here if you got back to your Christian roots. Because Bible church, that's a sect. That's even worse sect than the Baptist sect. I mean, you'd really be persecuted right out of existence. So let's be realistic about that. On the one hand, then, we have post-millennialists today. You say, well, Pat Robertson isn't a post-millennialist, is he? No, he's a confessional pre-mill. But he's an operational post-mill. Now, let me distinguish. Confessional pre-mill. If you said, what do you believe? Are you pre-mill, on-mill, or post-mill? Pat, he'd say, I am pre-mill. I believe Jesus is going to come, set up a kingdom, and reign. But then if you read his book, and I challenge you all to read it, if you haven't, even if you have made up your mind whether you're going to support Pat Robertson for the presidency, I suggest you get his book, The Secret Kingdom, and read the chapter on dominion. read the chapter on dominion. Pat Robertson believes in operational post-mill theology. He believes that you and I right now can take dominion over this world, including taking dominion over the forces of nature. He rebuked the hurricane and says that he wouldn't have run for president if he couldn't have done it. Somebody asked him, did your rebuking the hurricane have anything to do with your running for president? Pat Robertson said, well, if I couldn't have done that, how could I run a great nation like the United States? Taking credit for rebuking the hurricane himself, one, two, saying this is what boosted him into his presidential aspiration, and three, he says that you and I have that power today to rebuke earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, droughts, and poverty in the world, that we can right now, before Christ returns, take dominion over this whole earth, the same that Adam and Eve had in Genesis 1:28. Nonsense. That is absolute, unmitigated, unbiblical nonsense. There is no such thing. You can call yourself a confessional pre-mill, but he's really post-mill in his actual belief. We'll talk more about that as we go along. Good question, and we're going to speak to that more this evening and give a more detailed answer to it. But I think one of the things we learn from the Carter years is that you don't vote for someone simply because they're born again. One of the things we learned from the Nixon years is that you don't vote for someone, two things I learned, simply because of the party they belong to and simply because they attend Billy Graham meetings. Christians have very strange reasons why they vote for people, and none of those are good reasons. I would rather vote for an outright pagan who had the right policies than a born-again Christian who had the wrong policies. And I hope we don't make that mistake in the next election. But that's a good question, and we'll treat it more and more as we go along this evening. Well, what about 4B? Christians should practice it morally. As members of the church, we should model it, and as members of society, we should manifest it. It's not simply practicing a Christian ethic in our private life, but doing it in our ecclesiastical life and doing it in our social life as well. Now we get to the difficult one, 4C. I do not believe the church as church should be politically involved. I think Christians who belong to churches should be politically involved, but I think they should do it through political and social groups, not through the church as a church. Start an action group, join an action group, but do something. Don't just sit there. By changing people. Now, we're never going to change society from the outside in. The fallacy of postmillennialism, which says that ultimately we will set up a Christian government, and the main fountain head of that belief in America today is not Pat Robertson by any means, it's a guy named Rosh Dooney and the Chalcedon Group. Right over here in Tyler, Texas, one of his sons-in-law, Gary North, has his little holdout. They used to have a seminary there. Gary North, Greg Bonson, DeMar, Rosh Dooney are literally inundating Christian groups in America, playing on their patriotism, their Christian sense of responsibility, their overreaction to humanism, and teaching operational post-mill theology, even to confessional pre-mill. It's even influenced top Christian organizations in America. Say nothing to Pat Robertson. It's influenced Tim LaHaye's organization. It's influenced almost totally an organization called CORE, Coalition on Revival. It's influenced Campus Crusade, some of their leaders. to a degree, this operational postmillennialism that we are somehow going to Christianize America is really going to kill us. It's going to do more damage for what we really want to do in the long run than what was done by our withdrawing from society and doing nothing. And I'll say more about that this evening, too. What do we want to do then? We want to change people by evangelization. Matthew 28 is not a cultural command. Matthew 28 is a gospel command. Now, what the post-mills say is that Matthew 28 is a command to take over, and I'll quote Raj Dooney from the Rutherford Institute paper. Raj Dooney is on the board of the Rutherford Institute. John Whitehead is highly influenced by Raj Dooney. And I know you've had their attorneys here, and it's my turn tonight. You can ask me anything you want, like you ask them anything you want. I can tell you some stories that would be very interesting to you. But John Whitehead is a confessional pre-mill. But he's a naive, theologically unsophisticated, highly influenced by Raj Dooney, who is a sophisticated post-mill and who strongly influenced that organization. And here is what, in John Whitehead's Rutherford Institute paper, Raj Dooney, with a big picture of him, identified as a board member, here's what Raj Dooney said. Quote, "Christians must prepare to take over the world's courts and its governments," end quote. Why? What do I take over? To Christianize the world, to get it back to what it was in early America. Now, what was it? Post-mill, persecuting dissenters, no religious liberty, quote-unquote Christian America. I do not want that. I am not working for that. I am working side by side with them against the humanists, but I do not go with them the second mile they want us to go to establish a Christian country. What we need is not a Christian America, it's a moral America. What we need is not a Christian America, it's a free America. We're not really free now. And we want to do it by changing people from the inside out, not changing society from the outside in. You must be born again. We can't forget that. Also, we want to change politicians. See, in America, you not only are commanded to pray for Caesar and pay taxes to Caesar, but you can actually elect Caesar. And that makes our responsibility double as Christians, because in a democracy, obeying Caesar and paying taxes to Caesar and praying for Caesar, which are basically the three things that we're commanded to do, are actually transcended by our duty to elect Caesar and to elect the one that will bring this moral, free America back into existence that does not exist now. That's called democratization. Then thirdly, by changing policies, legislation. 1 Timothy 2:1 tells us how we ought to vote, and I think we ought to look at that passage. Because Christians, I am convinced, do not vote morals. They vote money. Poor Christians vote handouts. Hold on. Rich Christians vote tax dodges. Most Christians vote money. Bottom line, when you get right down to it, the reason Jimmy Carter lost and Reagan won is that one statement Reagan made. Are you better off than you were 4 years ago? You thought of the gas prices, you thought of that. And most Americans voted money. And we always have voted money. Now, I'm suggesting that if we're going to be Christian, we're going to have to vote morals over money. What was the problem with our three friends, all of whom come from churches that are opposed to abortion, that own this clinic? You know what the problem is? If they would drop out of that deal right now and cancel their contract to the Rooster Street Clinic, they would lose a lot of money. So it's morals versus money. That's the problem. Boils right down to that. Secondly, we must vote principle rather than party. Now, I don't care what party. I don't care whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. Jesus associated with the Republicans and sinners. It doesn't matter to me which party you tend to vote. But let me tell you something. And I tend to vote more on one side of the aisle than the other side myself. I won't tell you which side. But I'll tell you this. In the last election, a lot of people in this area went into the booth and pulled just one lever and voted a lot of good Democratic judges out of office. That's a shame. There are a lot of good, moral, principled judges that were voted out because some people voted straight party. We should be more discriminating than that and know what we're doing. All the good guys are not on one side of the aisle. There are actually some good guys on the other side of the aisle, whichever side you're on of the aisle. And Christians are going to have to vote principle over party and vote morals over money, and then maybe we can do something. Another point I'd like to make here. What about, now let's apply it to your last week discussion on abortion. What about this legislating morality? We're almost paranoid about legislating morality. In America, people say, oh, well, you just want to cram your religion down our throat. First of all, let's make a very important distinction. Legislating religion versus legislating morality. You know from what I've said already tonight that I am vehemently opposed to legislating religion. I don't want a post-mill theonomy, dominion theology back to our Christian roots, quote unquote. That's legislating religion. There's no religious liberty. I am in favor of religion, that you can't legislate morality. Not at all. In fact, I will argue that we not only can legislate morality, we must. In fact, everybody does, even the liberals. For example, did you ever meet a liberal who wasn't in favor of legislating civil rights? I've never. In fact, I'm for civil rights too. That's legislating morality. It's saying everyone, regardless of race, creed, color, national extraction, has the right to. That's right. That's legislating morality, though. Civil rights is legislating. Did you ever meet a liberal who wasn't in favor of open housing? Anybody has a right to live anywhere they want. They can afford to live there. Did you ever meet one? I've never met one. That's legislating morality. He has a moral right to live anywhere he wants to live. Did you ever meet a liberal who wasn't in favor of legislating against child abuse? Rape. That's legislating morality. You say, wait a minute. A lot of those principles come out of the Bible. Ah, now we have a very important distinction. Just because the moral principle came out of the Bible doesn't mean that if you're in favor of it, you're legislating religion. The Bible speaks against rape. If you have a law against rape, doesn't mean you're making the Bible the basis for society. It just happens to be a moral principle that God has revealed in his general revelation, Romans 2, 12 to 14, in the hearts of all men, as well as one that's in his special revelation. So here's what Christians should do. Your political platform should come out of principles that come from God's general revelation that are common to all men. All men know it's wrong to murder, to rape, to abuse children. That's contrary to nature. Homosexuality is contrary to nature, Romans 1 says. Sure, even the pagans don't live like that. Even animals don't live like that. So our platform, just because it's mentioned in the Bible, doesn't mean that we are making the Bible the basis for our political action. We're making good moral principles that are common to all men, that are revealed in the hearts and lives of all men, that also are revealed in the Bible, but we're not taking any uniquely religious principle that tells us how to worship God, when to worship God, and legislating no freedom of religion. We're simply legislating good moral principles that are necessary for the preservation of society, which are revealed by God to all men. Yes, we do want to legislate morality. You have only one other choice: legislate immorality. Because if you don't legislate morality, you're going to be legislating immorality. And just because it happens to be a Judeo-Christian moral principle doesn't mean that you have no right to vote on the basis of it. Francis Schaeffer, Christian Manifesto, did not make this distinction. He perhaps was a frustrated old man dying of cancer. I don't know what the reasons were he overreacted, but I can tell you one possible reason. Francis Schaeffer wrote that book under the strong influence of John Whitehead. John Whitehead is under the strong influence of Ross Dooney in the Post Mill. Thing Frankie Schaeffer has already become a Post Mill, I smell a rat. Unsophisticated pre-mills, that's most of us, unsophisticated pre-mills are dying by the thousands today because we haven't articulated our view, and the humanists have taken over America, and we're overreacting to the humanist takeover and falling right into the hands of the Post Mills, right out of the frying pan of humanism into the fire of post-millennial theocratic Chalcedonian Reconstructionism, that's all called by those names. You want to do away with the First Amendment? That's what the Reconstructionists want to do. That's what the Ross Dooney Post Mill Chalcedon group, they want to actually set up a Christian America. Even if you base the government on the Ten Commandments, what's the First Commandment? First Commandment mandates worshiping one God. That eliminates Buddhists, that eliminates Hindus, eliminates atheists, agnostics, skeptics, polytheists, Mormons. Is that what we want? Be careful. That's the direction we're going. It's way too far. No, and I don't want humanism in the schools being taught as a religion either. I mean, I've sung that song long enough. If you listen to my radio program, you know that I'm against that too, but I don't want to go the other way too far either.